3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning. It is currently 7 a.m. You're listening to 3CR Thursday Breakfast on August the 28th, and I have Alice and Leela in the studio with me. How are you both?
Good morning, Inez. Good morning, Alice.
It's nice to be here.
I know that there's been so much effort that's gone into today's show, and if you are following us on Instagram, which you can still follow us on 3CR Thursday Breakfast, you know that this is our International Overdose Awareness Day special. We've been doing it for the last few years, coincided with the first launch of the Victorian pill testing service, which we've been campaigning for so long. So it's really special that we get to hear from that at the end of the show. But I'm wondering if you had any reflections before we talk about what we're going to think about today.
Yeah, I think it's always, I really appreciate that we do dedicated shows a few times a year to different things where we get to revisit these things that are treated like news in the mainstream cycle and only visited very infrequently and briefly. So I really appreciate that we get to go in depth in revisiting something as important as overdose awareness and being able to actually pay our respect to the people that work in the field and the people impacted by overdose risk and overdose deaths. I'm really looking forward to hearing from everyone who's going to speak on the show today.
Yeah, it's a really important part of how to go about some real problems in the way we address some of these issues. And there is a sort of desperate need for better support for some of these situations. And it's good to not just have a whole sort of day every year dedicated to it, but that we can also put aside the show to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And today we're kind of taking you on a bit of a journey. We're going through a overview of the recent Victorian Coroner's Report, and then we're going to speak to two different clinical directors who are esteemed in their fields, kind of two different perspectives, and then the Victorian Pill Testing Service and like how to access it. So first up, we'll speak to Chris Christopher, who is the CEO of VADA, our lovely friends at VADA, and shout out to Dave Taylor for helping me coordinate this episode. Chris joins us to unpack a new report from the Victorian Coroner's Court, which sadly recorded that last year had the highest number of fatal overdoses in a decade. And Chris will help us understand strategies, advocacy, and what's next as Victoria's AOD peak body following the report.
Yeah, and after that, we speak with Associate Professor Dr. Shalini Arunagiri, an addiction specialist, psychiatrist, and researcher with a focus on the management of co-occurring mental health substance use disorders, as well as novel treatment for substance use disorders. She's the clinical director of the Hamilton Centre, Turning Point, and NHMRC Emerging Leader Research Fellow. And in our discussion this morning, we're going to learn about Professor Shalini's research into dual diagnosis care, AOD supports for vulnerable groups of people, and her mentoring of the next generation of mental health practitioners.
And then we'll hear from Associate Professor Dr. Nico Clark, who has worked in the field of addiction medicine for over 25 years, including 10 years at the World Health Organization in the substance use team, and as the medical director of the North Richmond Medically Supervised Injecting Room, and is currently the head of addiction medicine at a teaching hospital at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, and also is the clinical director at First Step in St Kilda. Absolutely stacked resume there. But Nico spoke to me yesterday about the differences in prescription versus non-prescribing drugs, why people often use multiple drugs at the same time, how does the coroner actually categorise fatal overdoses, how to improve patient care, and what we can all do to look out for each other. And then lastly, I also spoke to Sarah Healy, who is the director of the Loop's new pill testing service in Fitzroy. We discuss all the questions that people have about the service, what can be tested, how much should I bring, what about the police, what if I need extra support, drug alerts, and so much more. And we can find out more about how to access the confidential service and what to expect. And that's at 95 Brunswick Street, Fitzroy. It's open Thursday, Friday and Saturday at this moment. And you can also, yeah, reach out to them via phone or email, and we'll have more information on that later. But yeah, stay tuned for our headlines, and we'll see you in a second.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 28th of August. The Palestinian Authority has condemned dangerous escalations by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, after a raid in Ramallah injured dozens of Palestinians. In Gaza, Israel continues to use overwhelming force to occupy Gaza City, with tanks and warplanes leveling entire blocks and targeted airstrikes in populated areas, killing more than 100 people this week alone. This includes blatant targeting of journalists, health workers, and rescue workers in a double strike on Nasser Hospital earlier this week. A recent investigation by Palestinian and Israeli journalists shows that Israel has adopted the double strike technique as a standard in Gaza, with the first strike intended to kill people and the second intended to kill rescue workers who come to help. Gaza's health ministry has recorded 10 deaths caused by the Israeli-made famine over the past 24 hours, bringing the total number of hunger-related deaths to 313 Palestinians.
And in so-called Australia, over the weekend, we saw the mobilisation of record numbers in support of Palestinian liberation, with an estimated 300,000 people across more than 40 cities and towns rallying and calling for the Albanese government to stop the two-way arms trade with Israel and install sanctions against Israeli leaders. Since then, there's been no meaningful response from the Albanese government in response to the calls from the nationwide protests. Instead, this week, Albanese has been forced to clarify that moves to expel Iran's ambassador to Canberra are not prompted by Israeli interventions. Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu was quick to claim responsibility for the move, but the Labour government maintains the expulsion is in relation to claims Iran had a role in two attacks on Jewish synagogues, an accusation that Iran rejects. The Jewish Council of Australia expressed shock at the allegations from the federal government, and a spokesperson noted that, quote, "The fact a foreign government appears to be responsible shows how irresponsible it was for the attacks to be used to demonise the Palestine Solidarity Protest Movement," end quote.
In other news, the federal government has announced changes to the Centrelink debt policies, but welfare advocates say the reforms do not go far enough in meeting the recommendations of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission. While the announced debt waivers were welcomed by advocates, the government is being urged to immediately pause all debt collection and overhaul punitive recovery practices that continue to harm people. A spokesperson for the Anti-Poverty Centre said welfare recipients need a system focused on fairness and accurate payments, not one that punishes people for administrative errors.
Also in news this week, an independent report has found unacceptable levels of poor record-keeping and questionable use of force at Canberra's Bimberi Youth Justice Centre, including incidents where up to 10 officers restrained a single young detainee. The Act at the Australian Capital Territory National Preventative Mechanism that compiled the report warned that overcrowding is reducing access to education and health services and recommended staff wear body cameras to improve accountability. The Australian Capital Territory government, which failed to even respond to a similar report released 9 months ago, says it is considering the findings, but has failed to commit to adopting the recommendations so far.
Finally, in headlines, local environmental advocates have condemned the Victorian government's move to open the Otway coastline for further gas exploration, warning of severe risks to marine ecosystems. The proposed exploration consultation lacks detail about the exploration methods, and with little information for the community to comment on. The Otway Coastal Environmental Action Network is raising the alarm about the possible impacts and is encouraging residents and visitors to write a submission opposing the project. These have been the news
No, it's okay. Thank you. I love the enthusiasm. I just wanted to provide another update on the toll campaign, which we have been covering, which has kind of gone national. We've seen more graffiti that's been popping up in Sydney in relation to the campaign, as well as, saying no to logistics and imperialism and how the transport system often gets sidelined for how they also export and support the weapons industry. Not just that, but also through the Japan Post, which Toll is owned by. And from their recent interviews with Sydney criminal lawyers, I believe, they're looking for an in through being able to expand into Asia, particularly Japan Post, because they have similar imperial or military ties from their history as well. So I think that is an important thing to reckon with and a recall for another demand. You know, continuously we've plugged No Blogs, which you can find in our previous episodes as well. It's been kind of amazing to see that it's gone more national and the demands keep growing and more autonomous groups keep popping up. So I think revive some direct action that maybe has been missing in our community spirit for a little bit. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 28th of August. It's currently 7:13 and we'll be right back with our first interview.
Do you have a fine you're worried about? If you are struggling to pay a fine, there can be ways to help you deal with it. You may be able to get your fine lifted or reduced where you are experiencing difficult life circumstances, such as family violence, mental health challenges, disability, homelessness, or drug or alcohol dependency. If you have fines from not paying toll roads, you may also be able to get the fine waived if you're experiencing financial or other hardship. Speak to a community lawyer or financial counsellor to get advice on your options. You can find your local community centre on the Federation of Community Legal Centres website, fclc.org.au. You can find a financial counsellor by calling the National Debt Helpline on 1800 007 007. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is our International Overdose Awareness Day special programming. And first up, we have Chris Cristoforou, who is the CEO of the Victorian Alcohol and Drug Association, or VADA, who joins us to provide the first overview of the new report from the Victorian Coroner's Court, which recorded that last year, 2024, as having the highest number of fatal overdoses in a decade. And Chris will help us understand strategies and advocacy and kind of what's next for the peak body following the report. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, Inez. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Oh, welcome to have you back. I'm wondering if we could start off with not just the statistics or the research, you know, being involved for a while now, reading the report. What did it kind of leave you with, you know, as the peak body and as the CEO?
Oh, I think it's quite despairing to you know, read that 584 Victorians died of fatal overdose last year. That's obviously a lot of grief and suffering across the community for many families. So, you know, we're thinking of them this coming Sunday in particular, being International Overdose Awareness Day.
And I know, given the report, we saw certain demographics overrepresented and particular new patterns. And I'm wondering if you could, talk a little bit more about, what you have seen from the report and provide a bit of an overview.
Well, I think there's, an increased rate of overdose across a range of different drug types. So that's, quite concerning, particularly to see fatal overdose from use of methamphetamine to be, over 200 now. So but also particularly concerned about the number of fatal overdoses that are occurring in a range of hotspot locations like Greater Dandenong and Geelong. So, you know, in terms of how we respond to that, I think, you know, it's great to sort of see the drug checking site come online in the last week or so. However, I think, you know, there's a lot more that needs to be done to sort of reach communities right across the state.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that the drug checking service is only one part of the puzzle, and we'll be speaking to other people today as well. They'll be speaking to kind of the more clinical side, or, you know, pharmacotherapy. But I'm wondering, from the treatment services and what you know from, I guess, the VADA members, or challenges with responding to fatal overdoses, is it like lack of access or rural or regional places? Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Not unknown that you know, it's difficult to get access to treatment. Has been for a long time, and I know that there's work underway within the Department of Health to sort of look at ways of enhancing the way that we respond to these issues. But, you know, in saying that, you know, the current sort of status quo is that it is very hard to get treatment. In some cases, it's easier for people to, access, it's easier to access illicit drugs than it often is to sort of get into treatment pathways. So, you know, we need to sort of reverse that trend. And, you know, when people who use drugs identify that they might need help, that those pathways to help seeking are as easy as possible, and that as many doors are open to people who might have a substance use issue to get the help that they need.
I guess when we're thinking about fatal overdoses and clinical and treatment, so often I think the social aspect gets left out, or the relational aspect of telling somebody what you're using, making sure that someone can look after you. And I think a lot of that can lead also to stigma of like, oh, maybe I should use alone. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on how stigma and help seeking kind of interplay in this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a very good question. It's, you know, apparent that, you know, we've had 584 people that have died of fatal overdose in Victoria in the last 12 months, and yet, you know, there's no sort of mass outcry around that figure. So, again, you know, what will it take for governments, both at a state and Commonwealth level, to sort of be motivated to try to address this issue? Increasingly, I think, you know, we're sort of pinning our hopes on the next Victorian AOD strategy, as well as the next national drug strategy. But again, you know, we just need to see a genuine commitment to try to reverse these trends, rather than sort of, you know, saying that what we're doing at the moment is actually working.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we have talked about the AOD strategy before, and I guess the policy next moves. But yeah, I guess when you've spoken about wanting to reverse these statistics, what is kind of next for VADA as the peak body and for policy and advocacy to try to either prevent this, reverse this, or support it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of work that needs to take place, whether it's, you know, improving access pathways to treatment, improving access to pharmacotherapy, more harm reduction services, of course. You know, there's increasingly, I think there's the realisation that the decision not to proceed with the second CBD supervised injecting room has been a mistake and needs to be revisited urgently. So, and that more broadly, I think, you know, we need to sort of make sure that these types of services, whether they're harm reduction, prevention or treatment, are available across the state. So it's not just about having one site like the medically supervised injecting room, which does an amazing job in helping people who are intravenous drug users. But I think, you know, we need more of these types of services across the state, because, you know, the statistics are alarming, and we should be, motivated to do something about it.
But I know that previously the LGA of the City of Melbourne, which is why they wanted the second overdose prevention centre in there, was because they had the highest rate of heroin and ambulance call-outs and fatal overdoses from heroin deaths as well. I guess trying to revisit the conversation, what are the advocacy and policy conversations you might need to have, and like who kind of needs to be in the room?
Yeah, I mean, we need to, you know, continue to engage with all, you know, broadly across the community, you know, obviously with our members and service providers who are on the front line doing the work every day. We need to be listening to them and taking what they say seriously. But also, you know, it's important to sort of, you know, build consensus in the community, you know, from residents and traders. And obviously, I think, you know, we need to sort of call out those voices that really do try to create mischief by, you know, undermining sort of the work that is taking place to kind of keep people as safe as possible. So whether it's sort of campaigns around needle and syringe programs or voices that are often quite loud need to be called out and challenged, because what they're undermining is the evidence base of what works in keeping people safe, and that's a health-led response to drug use in the community.
So evidence-based has such a high success rate that if it was like curing any other, you know, social or physical mental health challenge, that everybody would be like, yeah, this is the best. Let's pour all our money into it. But you know, alcohol, other drug use is so heavily politicized. It's a health service, and really wanting to lead with that. And just finally, Chris, given the impact of the report and the day, yeah, the incredible work that VADA does, did you have any final reflections on what the International Overdose Awareness Day means for you, and what you would like to see from either our listeners or VADA itself?
Yeah, there's a range of events that are taking place across the state. You know, credit to all the services that are running those events to recognise the day and to remember those people that have passed away as a result of a fatal overdose. So, you know, for those that want to get involved and attend an event and support those who gather around those people who, you know, use the day to kind of remember the people that they may have lost along the way, I think it's important for us to get involved and attend those events where we can. So there's a whole range of events happening right across the state, and you know, I'd encourage your listeners to jump on the relevant website and have a look at what's happening in their local community and get out there and support the incredible work of AOD services right across the state.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chris. Yeah, we'll put that in our show notes as well. But yeah, if anybody wants to look up International Overdose Awareness Day and just type in events 2025, that will come up. But thank you so much for your time today, Chris, and really appreciate VADA's support over all these years as well.
Thank you, Inez. Thanks for having us.
Bye-bye. No problem. Thank you. Bye. And that was Chris Christopher, who is the CEO of VADA, the Victorian Alcohol and Other Drug Association, who joined me to unpack a new report from the Victorian Coroner's Court, which recorded 2024 as the highest number of fatal overdoses in a decade. It is truly a staggering and harrowing number. And Chris, you know, helped us talk about advocacy strategies and what is next. And stay tuned for the rest of the episode. We'll hear from some amazing guests.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised longing, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is ours.
Welcome to the Seaward District 30. 66.
Join us for a concert, speeches and food at Collingwood Yards to raise awareness for International Overdose Day. Come together as a community, pay our respects for those that have passed and survivors, friends and families. Performances by Resident Frequency, catering by Food Not Bombs, supported by Innerspace Crew and CoHealth, on the 29th of August, 2 to 4pm. Resident Frequency are a 3CR supporter.
You are a shadow, transparent, a memory once human. You pass through me.
Hi everyone, my name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website 3cr.org.au or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855am. And as part of our special programming for International Overdose Awareness Day, we are going to hear next from Associate Professor Shalini Arunogiri, an addiction specialist, psychiatrist and researcher with a focus on the management of co-occurring mental health substance use disorders, as well as novel treatments. She is the clinical director of the Hamilton Centre, Turning Point, and NHMRC Emerging Leader Research Fellow. In our conversation up next, we will learn more about Professor Shalini's research into dual diagnosis care, AOD supports for vulnerable groups of people, and how she mentors the next generation of mental health practitioners. Good morning, Shalini.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. So first of all, based on your research and career in dual diagnosis care, and I know you've got a lot of experience in the field and as a researcher, what mental health conditions do you frequently see co-occurring with addiction?
Yeah, we see really high rates of co-occurrence with both addiction and mental health problems, both within the drug and alcohol treatment spaces as well as mental health services. That can be as high as sort of 60 to 70% of people who are kind of seeking help from our services might have that co-occurrence. And the most common sort of things that we see are people facing depression, anxiety, and also really commonly have had traumatic experiences happen to them across their life and have PTSD or other trauma-related mental health problems.
Yeah, thank you, Shalini. Now, alongside these co-occurring conditions, how do things like trauma, PTSD and stigma contribute to a group of people's or an individual's overdose risk or frequency?
Well, what we know is for people who use alcohol or other drugs, the vast majority of people may not necessarily become dependent or develop problems with that use. But then if we think about that smaller group of people who might have problematic substance use, within that group, we know that traumatic experiences, PTSD, is much, much more common. And the rationale for that, the reason for that is kind of really obvious when we start to think about it, because substance use can be a very effective way of managing the problems that can arise from mental illness, and particularly around trauma or PTSD. Substance use can be a really helpful way to manage flashbacks, nightmares, sleep problems, difficulties kind of relating to people around you. And so for a lot of people, it's a way to kind of manage that internal pain, that way to cope. And when we think about sort of that dependence or that addiction, once that's developed, people often then have both those problems. They've got the PTSD as well as the substance use to try and manage. And when we think about overdose and overdose-related harms, within that group of people who are represented within overdose-related harms, we know that the rates of mental illness and the rates of kind of PTSD and trauma are higher in that group as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Shalini. And pivoting to vulnerable populations, you know, it's if you're part of a group of people that has limited access to healthcare, it's an obvious choice to potentially go to AOD for that support that you're not getting from the system. What can your research teach us about how to reach and supporting vulnerable populations, for example, young people with trauma or isolated older people experiencing loneliness?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, accessing healthcare can be challenging. And I think if you don't, you know, we often think within the Australian healthcare system, we often think about your general practitioner, your GP, as being that first port of entry, I suppose, to kind of healthcare. But for a lot of people, there's a lot of stigma. There are other barriers to why you might not want to speak to your GP about both mental health problems as well as substance use problems. And for addiction particularly, it's the most stigmatized health disorder. We know that there are a lot of shame and blame and judgment that can happen with opening up to someone else about the fact that they're using something. And so for people who are coming into drug and alcohol treatment services, we do see that outreach supports, being able to, you know, really have very kind of collaborative and inclusive ways of working with people, particularly people who might have had trouble seeking that care, younger people or people who are older and more isolated. Mm. Those sort of approaches mean that we can actually forge a relationship. It's that relational, that trust that you can actually build with someone that enables people to be able to understand how to access different types of care as well. And so through the Hamilton Centre, through other approaches that we look at integrated care, we're really kind of thinking about how do we offer care where people are entering the system, really, wherever they can get help. We want to be able to try and refer and link and support people to get the best care that they need.
Yeah. Are you able to give a bit of an example of a collaborative relational outreach method?
Yeah, I think it depends on where you're based within the system. And what we see through the Hamilton Centre and through Turning Point, because we do a lot of work across the state, we get the ability to kind of see some really amazing kind of pockets of excellence within services. I think within some rural and regional settings particularly, what we've seen is that capacity to really work with people really very flexibly over time. Mm-hmm. There are drug and alcohol services, for instance, who, you know, the workers who will meet you in a cafe, who will go for a walk with you, who will just, you know, be able to kind of work with people for what they need and where they need it. It also means, I think, within communities that have experienced a lot of harm and losses, is also being able to work flexibly with people and understand that as well. It might mean, for instance, to really match people with the kind of support that they need, and also look at opportunities to link people with peer support and lived experience workers within teams as well. And within the across the mental health sectors, we've had the local mental health and wellbeing services being set up in many communities. And that's a really great opportunity to embed a lived experience workforce within those settings, where we've got people at the front end who really have walked alongside people and have had those same experiences. And that enables people to actually be able to open up and trust in a way that we wouldn't be able to necessarily with clinicians at the front end.
Yeah. Now, I know another focus for you is women's health. And women have been habitually neglected in AOD research and treatment programs. What are some of the impacts of AOD on women's health, treatment for women, and homelessness? And why does it look a bit different to a more generalized model of AOD support?
For women who present with substance use problems, I think one of the, you know, obvious challenges is really the level of stigma and the level of sort of shame and blame that women can often face when they open up to a healthcare practitioner or a service about their substance use. And I think in societies generally we've had particular ways of viewing women and women's roles in societies and mothers in particular that mean that people face a significant kind of barrier to actually being able to talk to anyone without feeling blame or shame, and also the really obvious, you know, risk that people take about being reported to child protection. So that concern of, you know, if I have kids, if I speak to anyone about this, that there are major risks associated with that. And so that whole context colours, I think, how we offer treatment to women and what we're able to offer. It means that offering treatment to women that's more flexible, that's pragmatic, that is offered without stigma or shame. We know that services, for instance, that are anonymized or telephone or online-based, we see much higher proportions of women accessing those services than we do the kind of face-to-face, more confrontational service deliveries as well. In order to be sort of, I guess, responsive to women's needs as well, it also means kind of, I think, taking into account that what historically we haven't really engaged with as much. So women's health needs, including kind of menstrual health, reproductive health, women's pain, kind of thinking through how those kind of health problems may impact on and interrelate to someone's substance use issues as well. Historically, we haven't done a great job of that, and I think you know, people are getting more training, more exposure, and even the research is still relatively in its infancy in terms of helping us understand how these problems might interrelate. So what's really exciting, I think, is internationally there are research efforts to incorporate people of all genders into research efforts, and that really that requirement for that to be the case. And so we're starting to see how, for instance, if you're trying to quit smoking, how quitting smoking at different times in your menstrual cycle might, you know, boost or decrease the chances of whether that's going to work for you or not. So it's, you know, it has an impact across all kind of all ranges of the spectrum, and I think we're really only now starting to understand how to flex treatment according to those needs.
Yeah, it's really important that that research is expanded because, yeah, that it can look really different depending on, as you mentioned, hormones, if someone's on hormone replacement therapy, and also the social and systemic marginalisation that trans people face. It's really important that that's considered in AOD treatment and support. Now, you are the clinical director of the Hamilton Centre as well, which does have a focus on family inclusive services, which, as you mentioned, are really important for women's treatment. After 2 years of opening at the Hamilton Centre, do you have any reflections? And what do you think is working?
Yeah, it's just over 2.5 years now that we were set up. And the background to the service is that it came out of the Royal Commission into Victoria's Mental Health Services and was in recognition of the fact that lots of people, individuals and families were really telling that story of how if they had a co-occurring mental health and substance use problem, that often the services, the systems were set up in a really siloed way and people would get feeling like they were being bounced between services. They were often hearing, you know, go away and get your mental health problem treated first before we can work with the substance use problem.
Yeah.
And so in recognition of that, the Hamilton Centre was set up. And across the state, that centre includes a clinical arm, which includes 5 different health services that support the whole of the state. And that includes St. Vincent's Health, Austin Health, Goulburn Valley Health, Eastern Health, and Western Health. And together, these services are largely addiction medicine specialists, addiction psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, and peer workers who are able to engage with mental health clinicians and drug and alcohol clinicians to support them to better support their clients.
Yeah.
And so it gives us a really great opportunity to be able to work with the workforce across the state and see how we can actually change services and systems so people are able to get better care.
Yeah, we'll include details to the Hamilton Centre in our podcast notes as well today. And wrapping up, my final question is, you mentor students, you're a teacher. What do you think the next generation of medical practitioners need to know? And what are any gaps that you're noticing in their AOD education?
I think the really great thing that we've noticed over the last decade really is that students are really engaged and interested and enthusiastic about learning more about substance use problems. And I think what we've embedded within the curriculum over the last couple of decades is increasing exposure and content on substance use. Historically, health practitioners across the board and certainly doctors, medical practitioners, had little to no training in drug and alcohol problems. And that meant that, you know, when they were coming out into the workforce, when they met someone with a substance use problem, they didn't really know a tremendous amount about how to manage that. That is definitely changing, and I think the health courses now, undergraduate level courses, have a lot more content than they used to. What we're still really trying to work on now is embedding more capacity for people to have exposure to this in their placements and, you know, when they actually finish and they're doing the postgraduate training, to ensure that people feel comfortable and capable in this area, regardless of the type of specialty that they go into. But what we're really seeing is some real enthusiasm, some interest and some passion in this area. And we've seen really growing numbers of people specialising in drug and alcohol within medicine. So that's really exciting as well.
Shalini, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and insights. I really look forward to seeing more of your work in the future.
No worries. Thank you for having me on the program. Cheers.
You just heard from Associate Professor Shalini Arunogiri, an addiction specialist psychiatrist and researcher. And we heard about Professor Shalini's research into dual diagnosis care, AOD supports for vulnerable and marginalised groups of people, and how she mentors the next generation of mental health practitioners. And this is our International Awareness Day special on Thursday Breakfast. You're listening to 3CR.
District 3066.
Join us for a concert, speeches and food at Collingwood Yards to raise awareness for International Overdose Day. Come together as a community, pay our respects for those that have passed and survivors, friends and families. Performances by Resonant Frequency, catering by Food Not Bombs, supported by Inner Space Crew and CoHealth on the 29th of August, 2 to 4pm. Resonant Frequency are a 3CR supporter.
You are a shadow, transparent, a memory once human. You pass through me.
If you're just joining us, it is Thursday Breakfast on the 28th of August. It's our International Overdose Awareness Day special. We've really focused on a lot of clinical research guidelines, advocacy in this program. We've heard from Chris, who's the CEO of VADA. We've just heard from Associate Professor Dr. Shalini. And then we'll be hearing from Dr. Nico Clark and Sarah Healy from the Victorian Pill Testing Service. And I know it can be a lot of clinical chat, but I think I wanted to really talk about why, maybe personally, why this matters so much to me. Because I think I've grown up around a lot of grief and a lot of alcohol and other drug use, and, you know, lost very dear friends of mine. And I wish more than anything that when I was younger, somebody had taught me about naloxone or had taught me about, how to help friends or how to even have conversations with people that you know aren't doing well. I think when you're young, you're like, yeah, let's go to the club and nothing matters. But actually, it's hard to, I don't know, when you're not equipped with the tools to have those kind of relational conversations how to check in.
Yeah, and I think especially if you're around other people that have similar struggles and, you know, that suffering and that pain is really normalized and you're all developing ways to cope collectively, it is difficult to extend empathy that you didn't even realize you should be extending to yourself, to the people around you, to keep you all safe. So it's really, it means a lot that we have increased awareness about this. I've learned so much myself from my own experience as well. And having access to flexible supports, as Professor Shalini mentioned, is really important.
Yeah.
I've been lucky enough to use some of those flexible supports in my life for AOD support. And I really wouldn't have gone into AOD treatment if I hadn't had something flexible available to me. And I know that that's not available in other states.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's also been really interesting is, you know, going from somebody who was like engaged in that culture and supporting, and then also growing up in like the party club scene and then kind of seeing it from that end, and then going into social work and having to see it from a clinical crisis point of view, where often it was like social workers and medical team responding to overdoses and mental health episodes, and then going like through policy and then doing it through media. So often the things that I'm realizing is like there's so much amazing information out there that can be really hard to access. Like, who knew naloxone was free? You could just get it at participating chemists. And like
a reminder.
Yeah. We'll have links, but like,
yeah, you can go, you can search. There's a little map. You can see which chemists have it for free. Look it up. If you don't need it, that's great. If you think you don't need it, but you should get some for someone else who might need it.
Absolutely.
Everyone should know how to use it.
Yeah. There's actually, there's a training tomorrow, which we can talk a little bit about later, but it's through Harm Reduction Victoria on Friday the 29th at 299 Victoria Street, Brunswick. And yeah, it's just really cool that like we have this incredible technology that it's a nasal spray and it can reverse an opioid overdose. Like that's truly a medical marvel when we think about it.
Yeah.
And I've been hearing more and more also in the direct practice. There's a lot of people who are self-medicating for neurodivergence, particularly with like ADHD and autism, and a lot of the people in my life and in the practice as well, they get treatment for particularly ADHD and then finally feel like they can get a control over their substance use, which I think is something that we don't touch on enough, but that's pretty cool. But before we go on to our next interviews, do you want to say anything else?
I think I just wanted to pay my respects to all the beautiful people in my life that have survived overdose. I am so grateful for you. I love you so much. They're people that enrich my life so much. And I also want to pay my respect to the people that me and my community have lost to overdose as well.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll be right back with the next part of our show.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. We just want to plug that I know that this conversation can be distressing. Even though we're not going into any graphic detail, there are themes of trauma and loss and substance use. And support in Victoria, you can always call Direct Line. That's 24/7. That's 1-800-888-236. That's 1-800-888-236. And if you're listening anywhere else in the continent, you can call the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline on 1-800-250-015. That's 1-800-250-015. And it will redirect you to your local state or territory. You can always also contact the Suicide Callback Service, also 24/7, on 1-300-659-467. That's 1-300-659-467. And now you'll hear from Associate Professor Dr. Nico Clark, who has worked in the field of addiction medicine for over 25 years at the World Health Organization, with the medical director of the North Richmond Medically Supervised Injecting Room, and is currently the head of addiction medicine at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and the clinical director at First Step St Kilda. And we spoke a lot about the nuances of how the coroner records fatal overdoses, the differences between prescription and non-prescription drugs, how to coordinate better patient care, and what we can all do to look out for each other. So take a listen. I know that we are talking about overdose today, and we're seeing some of the stats that come out of the coroner's report, as we've discussed earlier in the show, is the highest that it's been in a decade, which is pretty harrowing. You know, 584 people died of an overdose last year, and these are people with lives and families and stories, and it's so easy to get lost in the statistics of it all. But I really wanted to talk to you from the clinical perspective, but I guess in your experience, why do you feel that this number is going up?
Well, the first thing to say is that, as you said, it is a lot. Whether it's gone up a lot or gone up a little bit, it's a lot of people. And, you know, fundamentally, overdose deaths are preventable deaths. And as you say, everybody has a family, people who care about them. So while it has gone up slightly on previous years, and there is a trend for it to increase, that, you know, it is a lot of people. And I think it is a good time to reflect and think, are we doing everything we can do to kind of reduce the number of people who die from an overdose, particularly an increase in deaths due to the use of illicit substances, and a small reduction in deaths due to the use of prescribed drugs. And that probably represents, well, two things. One, a change in the willingness for doctors to prescribe sedative medications. There has been a bit of a change in the way that doctors are prescribing, doctors and nurse practitioners are prescribing. I think there was a view for a period of time that we should treat everybody in chronic pain with opioids if they felt like that really worked for them. And, you know, they're swinging back away from that now because of the lack of evidence for the long-term benefits of this approach. A lot of doctors are cutting back on prescribing any drug of dependence because just of the squeeze we have on general practice in general, that people are getting more fussy about what they want to treat, as in their practitioners are. We're getting a lot of corporatized practices where they're also kind of choosing to focus on particular patient groups and not other patient groups. And so I think there has been a number of reasons why the prescribing of sedating medications or medications which can appear in an overdose as happening, some of which may be good, some of which perhaps represent a lack of access to care. So, but you know, that has resulted for a bit in a slight reduction in the prescription overdose deaths. But we are seeing, as you point out, a steady increase in illicit overdose deaths. It's difficult to say what causes a drug market to be the way it is. It's an illicit market. We have limited information about it. That has happened in recent years. Simultaneous to this, it's becoming more difficult to access opioid pharmacotherapy in Victoria, and we know that's one of the most effective ways of reducing opioid overdose deaths in particular. And so it might be worth thinking about whether or not that's both contributing to the rise in deaths and a potential solution to it. You know, opioid agonist treatment with methadone and buprenorphine, and now we have this, you know, long-acting injectable formulation of buprenorphine remain highly effective medications for people who are kind of wanting to regain control over their opioid use or stop their illicit opioid use. And we do have difficulty accessing that at the moment. So that's one factor which could be, we could say, is potentially a contributing factor. But as to the opioid market in general, it's difficult for us to know too much about it because it's, you know, it's by its nature an illicit market.
Opioids is something that continuously seems to come up. I wonder if you can clarify for us, like, are opioids always through prescription, or are they always illicit? Or, you know, we've seen new novel psychoactives, but particularly when it comes to like fatal overdoses, how do opioids kind of come into that conversation?
Basically two classes of opioids which result in overdose deaths. There's the illicit opioid market, for an injectable market, which is almost entirely heroin.
Yep.
Now there's sometimes other things mixed in with the heroin, but basically it's heroin. And we see hardly any fentanyl in Australia, you know, and hardly any nitazenes. Now, obviously, that could change rapidly, and occasionally we see it pop up here and there, but neither of those drugs seem to have entered in the market in any wholesale way at this point in time, the way they have in North America and other parts of the world. So, you know, that at least is something. In terms of prescription overdose deaths, they tend to be in people who have been prescribed opioids for chronic pain and have taken them in that context. There sometimes is some use of those prescription medicines by people they're not prescribed for, but the majority of deaths of prescription medicines are, in fact, for the people to whom they are prescribed.
A lot of these drug names, maybe for people who aren't in the sector or people who are listeners, it can feel confusing. I think I know that I've had conversations with people and be like, what's an opioid or what's the difference between a prescription? You know, acknowledging that overdose is not always, you know, one particular way, and there's often, you know, multiple contributing factors. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it typically does seem to be that there's multiple drugs involved in the overdose. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, you know, heroin, we've seen diazepam, Valium, methamphetamine, alcohol, and pregabalin.
Pregabalin, yes.
Yeah, as the five top contributing drugs. And I'm wondering why it is these particular drugs. I've seen particularly methamphetamine has been involved in overdose in Victoria, and has tripled since 2015. It's like, how do these deaths get recorded as an overdose? Are they like primary drugs? Yeah, I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think there's about 150 of these deaths are due to one substance, and the remaining kind of 550 are due to multiple substances. I think in this latest coroner's report, I don't think they've actually specified in the death that it was due to one substance what that one substance is. But I suspect that illicit and prescribed opioids, and the majority illicit opioids, are most likely to be the main substance in that category, but it won't be exclusively that. We can see deaths due to other sedatives and even to stimulants. I think in the past we kind of didn't recognize that stimulants alone can cause deaths. But the majority of cases, as you say, are kind of polysubstance, and that's for two reasons. One is that when you take more than one particularly sedative drug type, then it becomes more difficult to control the effects that you're going to experience, and you can kind of have a compound sedating effect. So if we're looking at respiratory suppression deaths, then taking multiple kinds of substances is, you know, much more likely to result in a death than taking one kind of substance, even if you take a lot of one kind of substance. So that's one reason why we see often multiple sedative drugs in these kind of co-contributing substances. And the other reason is that, like, most people take multiple substances. That's just what they do. Mm. And so the chances are, if they die of an overdose at any point in time, the chances are they will also have taken something else, because that's what they do on a daily basis. So it can become tricky to work out how many of these deaths were the stimulants are really a contributing factor or not. And it's a little bit difficult to work that out from the data that they've presented, and requires really a more detailed analysis that would only really take place if there was an inquest, for example,
yeah, of course,
rather than just a summary of the statistics.
Yeah.
So, you know, pregabalin is listed there, I think, in 92 of the deaths. Like, I think it's almost impossible to die taking pregabalin alone. But if you kind of combine it with kind of other substances, then it does increase the kind of total sedative load.
How do you record it as, like, a suicide versus a car accident, unintentional versus intentional? I don't know if you know how the research is, yeah, gathered in that way.
Some of that. I mean, so the coroner will try and determine whether or not every death is deliberate or accidental, you know, and whether or not the death needs further investigation,
yeah,
you know, so that they have to do in every state, every death. But then when you've got multiple, they will do an analysis of all the kind of bloods detectable in the postmortem sample, and there are various cutoff levels which kind of can be a guide to how much effect that might be having. And when people are taking more than a cutoff level, you say, well, this could cause dangerous sedation in somebody. Where it gets a little bit more complicated is that if people are taking these sedating medications every day, they get quite tolerant to them, and they're probably walking around with a blood level above this cutoff on a regular basis. And so to really work out, what's the main contributor requires a more detailed investigation and analysis of what have been that person's habits while they were alive. Were they prescribed that medication? Were they taking it every day? For how long? And so forth. And that's more detailed than will routinely be done for this data set, and would typically happen if there was an inquest, for example, and they wanted to do a more detailed analysis. So that's why the data here presents just shows all the drugs that were detected at significant levels,
yep,
without really saying which one is the one that's the kind of the one that's going to contribute more than the others.
Yeah, that's definitely helpful to kind of understand and contextualize the data, particularly when it comes to, yeah, like, polydrug use, where you use multiple drugs at the same time, including alcohol. Like, how do we look out for each other? I think I'm really curious about that. You've done so much work in harm reduction at the medically supervised injecting room at First Step and Royal Melbourne Hospital, really learning, yeah, like, how do you look after somebody, not just, yeah, like, clinically in the community as well? Because it seems like, do we need more harm reduction info, more information on mixing? Are people not seeing that alcohol is a drug or their own prescription medication? What's happening?
So there are lots of different things that we can do to look out for ourselves and look out for each other. If we're somebody who's using substances that can cause harm to, and almost every substance can, in the, depending on the dose, we can do to kind of reduce that risk of harm for ourselves or for other people. You know, we've seen through our experience in the injecting room, for example, that people can use substances in that context, And nobody has died from the substances they took in that context. And at least while I was there, we had kind of 500,000 episodes of substance use, and we had, you know, 7,000 overdoses, but everybody survived those overdoses. because there was somebody else there to keep an eye out for them, to give them naloxone if they needed it, and to call an ambulance if we needed it. And, you know, while I personally think it would be great to, you know, have more injecting rooms, and I think there is a good case for there to be one in the city, that, you know, that we can use those same principles for each other, if, you know, to kind of, if we're going to use something that's risky, to do it, use it when there's somebody else around in a way that they can support us. We can learn how to revive somebody. If we have naloxone, then that can, it's highly effective if somebody's taken an opioid overdose. But if we don't, it's fundamentally oxygen that our brains need. And, you know, that good old mouth to mouth resuscitation that we can all do on anybody, it's that oxygen that mainly that our brains are lacking if in a sedative overdose. And, you know, being prepared to call an ambulance if, you know, if things aren't going well, and to be in a place where we can do that. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's one approach. You know, the reality is a lot of people do use alone and in their home environments, and there are risks to that. You know, there are various things we could be doing in those kind of contexts that we're not. We think a lot of deaths occur in toilets, for example, because toilets are a place where people find it a private place to inject. But we could be putting overdose detection monitors in toilets, which are relatively cheaply, which could detect that. There's a kind of system where you can call somebody if you're about to inject alone, and, you know, then, or let them know you're about to inject them, and if they don't hear from you in 10, 15 minutes or even less, then they can raise the alarm if you want to. So there are different approaches like that. You know, there's the approaches we can take for ourselves if we're taking something that we for the first time, or it's we're not quite sure what it is or how strong it is, or then, you know, we should take a smaller amount rather than a larger amount. Since last week, you can take something if it's a substance that, you know, that's not a regulated substance that you don't know what it is, you can, or how strong it is, you can take it to the drug checking service that's just opened in Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, and then you can get a highly sophisticated analysis of what that substance actually contains. And then the broader thing, as you said, is to kind of like keep an eye out for how people are going. Are we in need of broader support? I mean, our experience looking after people who attended the injecting room is that many people, you know, not doing so well and weren't having a fantastic time of things, and just didn't know how to access that support. If you know, if we had the capacity to provide it, then we had a lot of people taking that up, you know, and that's on a professional basis. But I think if we, you know, and many people, when they're using, you talk about deliberate overdoses and accidental overdoses, that there's even for the accidental overdoses, there's a degree of, when things are not going so well in our lives, we kind of don't take as much care of ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's not that we're wanting to die, but perhaps we're not really caring so much that we're going to look after ourselves. And then, you know, we can, you don't need to be a professional to kind of recognize when somebody's struggling a little bit like that, and to kind of help support them, and personally or kind of help them get the professional help if that's what they need.
I think the most curious about something is, like, how do we, as a clinical director, like, how do you help support or mentor doctors and medical professionals to help coordinate better alcohol and other drug care? Because so often it is really politicized, really stigmatized, and can be really forgotten about. So how do you help coordinate better patient care?
So these days I spend the majority of my time in a major teaching hospital, the Royal Melbourne Hospital, and I spend one day a week in a kind of specific context for drug treatment, where in that one day a week at first step, you know, everybody is totally geared towards supporting the needs of this population.
Yeah.
In a broader health service, there's lots of conflicting priorities, and it's not necessarily something everybody's been taught about in medical school, nursing school, and you know, there's a surprising lack of kind of information that's made available during our training, both as to what it is that leads people to take different substances, and what we can do as a health service to intervene, you know, and all health services, but in particular hospitals are particular important places to be aware of the needs of people who use all kinds of substances. They're kind of people who use substances, including alcohol, are overrepresented in the hospital population. Whether it's the emergency department, it's drug use issues are emergencies, and it's kind of totally appropriate to come to emergency, but many people avoid emergency departments because they find them generally anxiety provoking places to be in the first place, and sometimes they are, you know, genuinely stigmatizing, and they don't treat people well when they do come in there. So, you know, we work a lot with the doctors in the hospital. We have a team in the emergency department to kind of say, well, if people come in here with health needs related to their substance use, we can respond appropriately. And one of those things is if anybody needs opioid agonist treatment, for example, we try and initiate it on the spot. I think it's such a valuable treatment that we, you know, we don't feel comfortable to kind of tell people to go away and find someone themselves. Will initiate it on the spot in the emergency department and kind of continue it until somebody can find a more convenient prescriber to kind of look after them in an ongoing basis. So that's just one simple example. But, you know, every now and then people in this population get very sick. So, you know, they may have an infection related to injections, which can be life-threatening and often need life-saving care. And then sometimes people have serious psychiatric complications from injecting or non from methamphetamine use. People can start to lose a grip on what's real and what's not real. And then we often see those presenting as well. So the hospital system is really an important place where we can respond well to a whole range of substance use issues. If we have the right training and we understand the needs of that population. But without that, you know, sometimes the hospitals struggle with the competing needs and all the various pressures on them to do the best. So at the moment, I'm working hard to kind of my colleagues understand people, you know, are in the situation that they're in when they come to hospital, to treat them the same as anybody else, to kind of make an assessment of what the issues are and what we can do to support people, and then try to provide care, yeah, keeping in mind the trauma that somebody might have experienced, something, you know, kind of trauma-informed, if you like, care, so that it makes it easier for people to accept that care as long as they need it and get the best outcomes that they can.
And that was my conversation with Associate Professor Dr. Nico Clark, who is the former Medical Director of the North Richmond Medically Supervised Injecting Room and currently the Head of Addiction Medicine at Royal Melbourne Hospital and the Clinical Director at First Step St Kilda, where we spoke about clinical harm reduction, you know, medication, it's also called pharmacotherapy, and care coordination. And just reiterating again that Directline is available for anybody that wants to contact in Victoria about alcohol and other drugs 24/7. That's 1-800-888-236. That's 1-800-888-236. And the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline, which is 24/7, on 1-800-250-015. Just reiterating as well that, you know, if you do experience or see an overdose is a medical emergency, and to call 000 immediately and ask for an ambulance. Phone operators will guide you until the ambulance arrives, which is also why you should carry your naloxone, get the training, which is available tomorrow, Friday 29th at Harm Reduction Victoria. We'll put that in our show notes as well as local IOD events. And next up, you'll hear from Sarah Hilly, who is the director of The Loop, which is a new fixed pill testing service in Fitzroy, where we've spoke about all the frequently asked questions about the service and how you can access it. And it's currently open Thursday, Friday and Saturday. So take a listen. Thanks so much for joining us here today on 3CR Thursday Breakfast. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I was wondering if we could start off with telling us about what the drug checking service is and kind of how it's come about.
Yeah, absolutely. So our drug checking service is called the Victorian Pill Testing Service. And back in June 2024, the government made the courageous and well-needed decision that they were going to trial drug check-in here in Victoria for the first time. So this is an 18-month implementation trial. The government have been quite clear that they know drug check-in works, but that this trial is to test different modes and models of providing that drug check-in service. And so for 18 months, we'll be running this service, and it's a mix of us attending festivals and events and also opening our fixed site service at 95 Brunswick Street in Fitzroy.
Yeah, beautiful. I know that we've had like mobile testing at festivals before, and going off the success of Canberra and in Queensland, seeing a fixed service. What do you think differs between a mobile service and a fixed address service?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, there's a lot less dust at a fixed site service and a lot less booming noise. So look, both festival delivery of drug check-in services and fixed site have their place. For festivals, you'll get into a key demographic of people where there's often a higher proportion of people using drugs, and you are there at the place they're most likely to take drugs. So you're situated in that place. What I'm really excited about with the opening of our fixed site service is it provides equity of access. You don't need to have had to have afforded a ticket to go to an event, a specific event as well, because we can't attend all events. And it means that anyone who uses drugs has access to this service.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, having a fixed site, it definitely opens up the accessibility of the service. So I'm wondering, as the director, like when you were thinking about, like working in collaboration, I'm sure it's no easy feat, but what can people expect when they're walking into the service?
Good question. So we've got quite a discreet entrance. You will find us at 95 Brunswick Street, and you'll find us with a big purple front door with a big open and close sign on it. Anyone can press the front door, and that door opens, and they can walk straight into our reception area. In our reception area, we'll just confirm that you're here for the purpose of testing your drugs, and then we'll take you through to a waiting area. In our waiting area, we have tea and coffee and music, and staff are around to answer any questions and explain how the process works. And you'll be given a tablet to fill out where you'll read through a disclaimer. All drug check-in services want to ensure that people who visit them understand that there are always limitations to testing. And you read through that disclaimer, you sign to say you've understood it, and then if you feel comfortable, you can give us some demographic data, which you can choose whether you want to give us that or not. Once you've completed that process, we will offer you a space in our sample drop-off room, and you'll speak to one of our scientists who will take a very, very small sample of your drugs, ask you a couple of questions about those drugs. You can bring more than one drug type in, so people sometimes drop off several samples at a time. And once that's complete, you'll return to our waiting room where the scientists go through their testing processes. So we have a number of analytical instruments that are used. In a few weeks' time, our paper spray mass spectrometer will be up and running, our PSMS, and that will be able to be a fast and efficient instrument that everyone can get really good results from. But until then, we're using two other pieces of instruments called the FTIR machine and a portable GC-MS, which we use at our festivals. So once the scientists have tested the samples, they'll input all that into a database which our harm reduction team can look at. And then once those results are ready, a member of the harm reduction team. The harm reduction team's made up of peer workers from Harm Reduction Victoria and healthcare workers from the Loop Australia. They'll be able to take you into one of our private consultation rooms to provide you the results. And then if you're interested, we can also provide you with any harm reduction information that you want to receive or referrals to other services if that's what you need and want as well.
Yeah, amazing. So I'm thinking about the minute someone walks into the testing, and then receiving the feedback. How long does that process kind of take?
That's a really good question. So if you have no one waiting in front of you, the process is really quick. It can take 15 to 30 minutes in its entirety. depending on how much you want to sit back and chat with us. But the actual testing is quite quick. Sometimes it can take a little longer if you've got a few other people in front of you waiting to drop off their samples. We will start over the weeks. We will start to get a sense of our busier and our more chilled periods. So we'll try and communicate that out to people. So if they want to be as speedy as possible, they can pick a time. Equally, anyone is always welcome to phone us on our 1-800 number, which you can find on our website, just to check in on how busy we are before arriving.
Okay, awesome. And are there any like limitations for the kinds or the amounts of drugs you can bring in? Like, are you bringing in like full bags? Are you bringing like weed and ketamine and MDMA? Like, I'm curious about like the load that might take on the service.
And this is what these are two of the most common questions we get. What can I test and how much should I be bringing in? So what's really important for everyone to understand is that the law has been changed so that once you step into our premises at 95 Brunswick, you are actually protected from prosecution for a personal amount of drugs. Now, people always ask, what's a personal amount of drugs? Well, it's under a trafficable amount. So for most pills and powders, that's under 3 grams, but it's a very big list in the Act. And so we'd always advise people to check with us beforehand if they're not sure. But equally, we want people to be as safe as possible because outside of this building, the law is as it normally is. So we encourage people just to bring in a small personal amount, under a gram, or maybe just one of their pills, one of their capsules, if they've got a couple of them in the bag. And that means that's just reducing their risk outside, as well as ensuring that they're under the trafficable amount. The other question you asked was, what can we test? Well, we can test most pills, powders, capsules, and liquids. We aren't able to test edibles or plant material. So that would be, you know, cannabis or mushrooms. That being said, if someone was concerned that a chemical adulterant had been added to one of those plant-based items, we could give it a go. What we say is, if you're not sure, either give us a ring or pop in and see us and have a conversation. And even if we're not sure, we'll give it a good go. The other thing is, we're getting lots of questions about whether we're going to test steroids. We will be testing steroids, but that's going to be in a few weeks' time. So hold your horses, be patient with us, and we'll be sure to let you know when we start testing steroids.
Cool, awesome. So I'm kind of hearing that in a few weeks you'll have paper spray mass spectrometry and you'll be able to test steroids. And right now it's just like, yeah, starting post the launch. And when it comes to, I guess, what one gram is, that's kind of the suggested amount under the trafficable amount of 3 grams. What is 1 gram? I've heard it's like one matchstick. Is it like a little frozen pea? What visually is like a 1 gram?
I also heard someone referring to it in matchsticks as well. And I kind of like that as an analogy. I think the concern for me, you know, our eyes are not scales.
Yeah.
And I would be concerned on trying to give a visual comparison in case, you know, you had something. If you had something that was slightly moister, that's going to be heavier. If you've got something that's very dry, that's going to be a lot lighter. And so I wouldn't want to put something forward that then is incorrect for someone's own personal experience. So
yeah.
What we say is just bring a small amount in. We will be taking a photograph of it if you're happy for us to do so. But yeah, it's really important that we want everyone that comes in here to be safe. And there's one other thing that I forgot to mention. It's sure. The fact that we're confidential and anonymous, which I think is another really important point. At the end of the day, we're not going to ask you for any identifying information about yourself. And we also, any questions we do ask you are completely optional as to whether you would like to respond to them.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, no identifiable questions. So I guess when you're asking, I guess what kind of questions can you expect to be asked when you come in?
Well, at the beginning, as I mentioned, we've got some questions about your demographics. We're keen to really understand the groups of people that are visiting us, but also the groups of people that we might be missing out on and need to do some really good promotion to, so we can ensure that they're coming through our doors. If you do want to kind of delve down a bit more on that harm reduction advice on how you can keep yourself safer, we can ask a series of questions around, you know, we can talk to you about your physical and mental health. We can ask you what your experience is of using certain drugs. and then work out what are the gaps that you might want to know. But really, it's about consumer choice and consumer-led. Like, we meet people where they are, and we don't want to be given information where it's not wanted or needed. We do also have a range of harm reduction topics that we'll cover off with people if they're happy to have those conversations.
Yeah, cool. So is that kind of like a wraparound services for like mental health and like housing? Is that kind of the sort of linkages that might be?
Yes, for people that would be interested in more, they need them for sure. For a lot of people, the main thing they're going to want is, I want to make better informed choices about my drug use to keep myself safer, and I want the results.
For sure.
Anything we do beyond that is just a plus addition.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing. And yeah, I think you mentioned it earlier about anonymity, but also about, yeah, like carrying drugs to the service. I think the one thing that I've heard a lot of people describe their concerns about is like, sure, like once I step into the service, I'll be okay. But what about any point around that? Like, is there a concern that, because this is new service, like police are going to be patrolling the area to try to like gotcha people. Yeah, do you have an agreement? Yeah, I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, and again, really, really important question to ask, because that's a natural concern for people. So what we do know is the police have been instrumental in supporting the legislation going through, the legislation trained, and they are seeing this as a health service, as a harm reduction service, and it's not an opportunity to, get in the way of our service delivery and get in the way of people receiving this information. So look, the Chief Police Commissioner has provided them, their police members, with a set of instructions on how they should operate in relation to our service. And it's a bit like, I'd compare it to needle syringe programs or the medically supervised injecting room. These are all harm reduction health services. And if you have too much of a police presence, people will not come. So police have got direction on not loitering in the area, in the vicinity. Police have got instructions on that they shouldn't be targeting anyone just because they've come in and out the building. And indeed, in our festival experience, police have been really supportive in making sure we can get the outcomes that we're set up to deliver, really. So we will continue to monitor that and ensure that the police are doing what they should be doing as well.
Okay, amazing. Yeah, this is so helpful and really helps like clearly picture what the service looks like, what you can expect going in, going out. I'm wondering, yeah, what the launch was like, because that was only a few days ago. So exciting. And there's like media about it, and I'm sure it's been a lot of work. But yeah, I'm wondering if you could talk about like what it was like kind of leading up to the launch and what the launch has been like and what you're left with.
Certainly, it was a bit of an uphill challenge for us. The Fit Out company obviously had been working really hard to get this beautiful space for everyone ready in time, and they delivered that on schedule, which was really made us very happy. We'd been doing a lot of prep work in the background with the recruitment, with working out how the service is actually going to work and writing various documents. And we'd also been doing quite a bit of work on how we were going to alert the community about any harmful substances if we found them. So we have a whole process in place for that. But come Wednesday, when we were doing the launch with the minister, we were like, this is exciting. We are on the verge of running the first fix site in Victoria. And I know this is on the back of so many people advocating tirelessly for years, and so many people needlessly come into harm because drug checking services weren't available. So I'm just such a sense of relief that we're finally open and that people are coming through our doors. We've had really good uptake in these first 3 days we've been open, and that's really warmed our hearts that people are trusting and are happy to engage with our service and come and get their drugs tested.
That's so wonderful to hear. Yeah, it's been such a long, long battle. And I know there's so many strategies, but I think, yeah, it's each services coming together to do so much harm reduction in the state, and particularly in the LGA that has some of the highest overdose rates in the entire Australia. I also wanted to, yeah, I was curious about the drug alerts because, like, I know that it could come up on social media and we could, like, see the drug alerts there or by email. But I'm curious about, yeah, what the process is for drug alerts and also for people that maybe don't have a phone or are not, you know, social media connected. How do they also know that the drug alerts are there?
Yes, well, this is a work in progress, yeah. And we'll continue to expand how we do this. But you're right, first and foremost, we'll be getting, if we had an urgent alert to send out, we'd be sending that out within 4 hours of making that decision that this needed to go out. But we will primarily be using our social media channels, so following us on Insta, on TikTok, follow on our Facebook, and we've obviously got our website. But we'll also be mailing out to anyone that wants to receive those. And so what we'll be doing over the coming weeks is setting up a page where, in fact, people can use our inquiry form now. If you want to be on our drug alerts list and we'll send an email out, you can just put in an inquiry and let us know your email address and we'll add you to the list. But we'll also have a heap of service providers and other key stakeholders that will be sending that information out, because the idea is to then spread the messaging as far and wide as possible. And there's a lot of other service providers out there that then repackage those and send the same messaging out to their community in their voice. So we see this kind of chain of events where we'll put it out. It will go up onto a centralized website called The Know. They collect nationwide alerts that are going out. And we are also really keen for everyone to share that on, share it with their friends, loved ones, and people they work with, to get that information out as widely as possible.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, so we'll definitely have a lot of that in our show notes. And I guess finally, how can people access the service? And I know this is like one area to help us keep safer from alcohol and other drugs, but yeah, is there anything else that you would also recommend to our listeners? Naloxone, we've been pushing Naloxone forever, but yeah, what would you recommend about how to access the service and any other tips on how to stay safer?
Like, literally, all you need to do is drop in during the hours we're open. So we're open from Thursdays 1 till 4. I've got that wrong already. We're open Thursdays 12 till 4. We're open Fridays 3 till 7. And we're open Saturdays for a much longer period of time, from 1 till 7 p.m. You literally need to rock up to the purple door, press the green button, and that will open Sesame for you and you can walk in.
Okay, amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time and insight. It's been such a long time coming, so really excited. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast. It is our International Overdose Awareness Day special. You can find all the information in our show notes, and we'll see you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.